everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning here on the Progressive Radio Network. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green, and I'll be with you for the next hour talking about our food system, what's in the news, what you can do to make change. And I also have a wonderful guest that will be joining me later in the show, Mish Bakker, who is the author of a new cookbook called Cooking with Flowers, Sweet and Savory Recipes with Rose Petals, Lilacs, Lavenders, and Other Edible Flowers. So stay with us for that. But for right now, I just want to talk about what's going on in the news. And as I'm sure so many of you heard, the Farm Bill was defeated in the House this week. And as much as we all want a new, fair, honest Farm Bill, the one that was presented to the House certainly was not that. And so I personally am glad that it was defeated. However, I do want to have a Farm Bill passed. So the Farm Bill that was on the floor to be voted on did not have any provisions for revamping the crop insurance subsidies that is so out of whack and that really only benefits the very large monocrop farmers. We really need farm insurance that really helps the small family farmer if they get hit, because they're the ones that really get wiped out. We also need more provisions to benefit organic farming and sustainable agriculture. We also could not afford to have a Farm Bill passed that cut billions of dollars from the SNAP program, that's the food stamp program, which that bill did. So I'm glad to say that it did not pass, but we all need to write to our representatives and let them know what's important to us in the Farm Bill. And you can find out more information about that on the Slow Food USA website. They have information about it. You can also find more about it on Cornucopia's website. There's plenty of websites where you can find out more information about it, but make sure you know where your information is coming from and that it is honest reporting, okay? You know, nothing that has to do with the Koch brothers or Fox News, you know you will not get honest reporting from there. Also, the U.S. approved for the first time a label for meat that allows you to say that this meat was raised without GMOs. That's without genetically modified products. And that's a really great, great thing for us. It's a non-GMO project, verified, and that label is, you know, what you want to look for. So if you're getting something that's not organic, because organic up until now has been the only thing that you can really feel confident was GMO-free. Now there's also this labeling called the non-GMO project, which I've talked about before, and for the first time they are actually allowing that on meat products. So if you cannot afford organic meat, or the farmer that you're getting it from is not certifying organic just because they don't want to spend the money, that's fine. But at least now you can know that it's GMO-free, and that's an important thing. So look for the non-GMO project label on the meats that you do buy. But, you know, on one hand, the Agriculture Department does that, and then the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, who is supposed to be out there looking out for our best interests, they just raised the allowable amounts of Roundup that is allowed to be on produce. That's the residual pesticide that remains behind. And there was a certain limit, which any, as far as I'm concerned, is too much, but there was an allowable amount. And now they have just raised that amount so that even more residue of Roundup is allowed to be on our produce. So that's just another reason to know where your vegetables are coming from. Buy organic if you can. You know, also in the news, nothing new to us. Hot dogs, bacon, red meat is tied to increased diabetes risks. So, you know, it's just amazing. You know, you look at the news and you see all these products that are everyday foods in this country that are actually banned in other countries. It's just amazing to me how behind our country is in protecting its people and how much more committed it is to protecting big, big business. So we all really need to step up our action and, you know, let our government officials, let the agencies that are in charge of regulations, let them know how we feel. You know, they've just approved genetically modified potatoes. You know, and these GE potatoes will look just like all other potatoes. And there's a petition at the on the USDA website to sign a petition. Actually, the petition is not on the USDA website, but the petition is on my website, and you can sign this petition that will be sent to the USDA to stop the approval of a genetically modified potato. It just goes on and on, you know, all the manipulation of the foods that we are eating. And so it's just really important for all of us to, you know, start shopping at our farmers markets. If you don't know where they are, you can go to a website called localharvest.com and find out where your local farmers market is. It's a great way to buy local and to actually meet the farmers. It's a really, and it's just a great feeling. And depending on where you go and what city you live in, some farmers markets are big festivals, it feels like, every weekend, you know, selling food and drinks and pastries. And it's just, you know, a fun place to go. It's a great place to bring your kids. And also, there are some spaces still available in some CSAs, that's Community Supported Agriculture, so you can also check the website there. Again, on localharvest.com, you can find that out. There's a few things going on around town. Yoga in the Garden continues. After my show, I will be running out to my yoga class at Old Westbury Gardens every Thursday and Saturday mornings from 11:15 to 2:30. But there is yoga everywhere. This past weekend was the summer solstice. We had a wonderful, wonderful Slow Food Huntington event on Friday evening at Restoration Farm celebrating the summer solstice. And on Saturday, there was over 2,000 people doing yoga in the middle of Times Square. And they were welcoming in the summer as well. So yoga is really big. And doing it outdoors is really big. So look for places you can do yoga outside. It really feels right to be doing yoga outside. I have some seasonal cooking classes coming up. The next one is July 3rd. There is still space, so sign up. Their menu is posted on my website at iegreen.com, and it is focused on summer entertaining, vegetarian summer entertaining, grilling tofu kebabs and tofu sliders and making, it's all gluten-free, so if you're gluten-free, have no fear, the class is gluten-free. We'll be making some gluten-free chocolate chip cookies, some grilling, and baking. So there's still room, as I said, for the July 3rd class. And then July 18th, for the first time ever, I am partnering with a chef and nutritionist from Madrid. Her name is Carla Trigo, and she has been working with people to enhance their libidos with magical secret foods. So this class will be designed to bring out the foods that really help raise one's libido. And I know from being out there talking with so many women that that is an issue for so many of us. So come on out and find out what foods you can eat to raise your libido. That's July 18th, and there is space, and you can register. There's a link from my website to the Eventbrite page where you can register. This Sunday, Slow Food Huntington is having a Small World Dinner. That is a potluck event where we are asking people to bring a favorite recipe from their family's history, tradition, culture, and bring it to share with new friends and old friends alike at the home of a member in Huntington. And when you go on the website and sign up or send me an email, we will send you the directions to the home. So hope to see many of you there. Tuesday, July 9th, there's an edible and medicinal walk with Dr. Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse. Ellen Kamai also has a radio show on the Progressive Radio Network. She is a wealth of information. We did this walk last year, and it was sold out and super popular, so we are bringing it back again. It will be here at IE Green in Old Westbury, and we will just be walking around the property and finding out about all the weeds that I'm constantly pulling that we can actually eat that are medicinal and have nutritional value. And we're also doing that as a potluck, but we will also be cooking up some of the edibles that we pick. So come on out for that on Tuesday, July 9th. On July 10th, at the Cinema Arts Center, there is a screening of Soul Food Junkies, which I've talked about before. I went to another screening, and it was such a great movie that we are bringing it to our local cinema in Huntington on July 10th at 7:30, and it will be followed by Q&A. We have a guest from WBAI talking about food, as well as Lisa Dent, the chef and owner of L.L. Dent Soul Food Restaurant in Carl Place. And she will also be providing food for the reception. So it's a great, great evening, movie, reception, and question and answer session. So come on out for that. And July 11th, Slow Food Hunting is having an open meeting and potluck, also at the Cinema Arts Center. We're very fortunate to have the use of their cafe as our home base. And so we have most of our meetings there, but they have a beautiful outdoor garden. So if the weather is good, we will be sitting outside talking about where we'd like to see the Slow Food Huntington chapter go and what things we'd like to focus on. Save the date for the bus going down to Washington, D.C. That is coming up, and I believe that is July 20th. 9th, yes, July 29th. 350.org is having a huge rally in Washington to protest the XL Keystone Pipeline. I don't know if any of you saw, but one of Obama's people came out this past week really, really coming forward saying how bad the Keystone Pipeline is, and if President Obama really cares about climate change, there is no way he's going to approve that. There's nothing in it that is good for the U.S. So, you know, if you can join us on July 29th and make sure that President Obama knows how we all feel, that would be a really great thing. So save the date for that. Okay. So before I move on to inviting Mish Bakker on as my guest, I want to share with you this week's recipe. And it is a vegan, gluten-free eggplant parmesan. And it's really funny because yesterday in the dining section on the front page is all about the eggplant, talking about this versatile vegetable, which is really a fruit. I actually didn't even know that. It's in the same – I knew it's in the same family as tomatoes, which is also a fruit, so that would make sense. But eggplant is a vegetable that we can do so much with, and it really can be the centerpiece of your meal. So this vegan eggplant parmesan dish is really great. You're going to start with two large eggplants or three medium ones. Cut lengthwise into about quarter-inch slices. And you're going to actually lay those out on a cookie sheet or on the counter and sprinkle them with some salt. And that just brings the any bitterness in and juice from the eggplant up to the surface, which you then can wipe off. And it makes the eggplant a bit tastier. So you need two large eggplants, 1 tablespoon flaxseed, 1 cup of almond milk, extra virgin olive oil, salt and freshly ground black pepper, 3 cups of gluten-free breadcrumbs, and then I season those breadcrumbs with 2 teaspoons oregano, 2 teaspoons basil, 2 teaspoons garlic powder, salt and pepper. And that's what you need for the eggplant. For the marinara sauce, you need 2 tablespoons extra virgin olive oil, 1 medium yellow onion chopped, 6 cloves garlic minced, 1 8-ounce package of mushrooms sliced thin, 1 organic yellow pepper chopped, 1 teaspoon dried oregano, salt and freshly ground pepper, 10 organic sun-dried tomatoes pureed, 1 bay leaf, 2 32-ounce jars of organic marinara sauce, whatever marinara sauce you like to use. If you have a homemade one or you want to make a homemade one, great. 2 tablespoons chopped parsley. And then for the cashew ricotta, you need 3 cups of cashews that you soak for 3 hours, or you can soak them for overnight, 2 cups of water, 1 teaspoon sea salt, 1 tablespoon good-tasting nutritional yeast, and 2 cloves garlic. And then for the topping, I use 1 package of rice mozzarella, and I don't even use the whole package. It's really just for the visual effect. So as I said, you're going to start by laying the eggplant out on the counter and sprinkle with some salt. Let that stand for 20 minutes or longer and wipe off the liquid that comes out of the eggplant. In a glass pie pan, make a mixture with the flax seeds and the almond milk. You're going to dip the eggplant slices into the almond milk mixture and then into the gluten-free breadcrumbs that you've seasoned with the herbs. And then I line 2 baking sheets with parchment paper. Brush the parchment paper with olive oil and lay out the eggplant. Then with a olive oil spray, I spray the top of the eggplant, and I bake it in a 400-degree oven for about 20 minutes, turning it over halfway through until they're golden brown on both sides. And this is really much easier. You can, of course, saute it on the top of the stove in some olive oil, but that uses a lot more olive oil, makes a splatter all over, and it's just really easy to just put it on cookie sheets and get it in the oven. And while that's in the oven, you can be putting together your marinara sauce and your ricotta cheese mixture. So the marinara sauce, you're going to heat the olive oil in a large pot over medium heat. Add the onions and cook, stirring with a spoon until lightly browned. Add the peppers, the mushrooms, and the garlic. Continue cooking for about 5 more minutes. Add the marinara sauce, bay leaves, sun-dried tomatoes, and spices. And let simmer for about 30 minutes. If you want to add some white wine or red wine to the marinara sauce, feel free to do that as well. That always gives it a depth of flavor that you will appreciate. For the cashew mixture, you're going to drain the cashews, and then in the food processor, you're going to pulse the cashews until finely chopped. Add the water, salt, garlic, and nutritional yeast, and keep pureeing until they're very smooth. And then you're going to assemble the eggplant. You're going to lower the oven to 375. Spray a large Pyrex casserole pan, the one I used was like 10 by 14 by 2 inches, with olive oil. Put marinara sauce on the bottom, and then lay out your eggplant slices onto the bottom. And I'm doing 3 layers of eggplant, so I divide the eggplant into thirds. Cover the bottom of the casserole pan with the eggplant. Ladle some marinara sauce on top. Spread half of the cashew mixture evenly over the eggplant. Repeat with another layer of eggplant, marinara, and the cashew cheese. And then you're going to top with 1 more layer of eggplant and just marinara sauce. And then you're going to sprinkle it with the rice mozzarella. And like I said, the rice mozzarella just gives it the look that people are looking for eggplant parmesan. Do I think rice mozzarella really adds any flavor to the dish? No, not really. But it looks great. So do that and bake it for about 30 minutes, covered with some tin foil, and then remove the cover and cook for another 10 minutes. And that keeps the mozzarella cheese from getting too dark. Okay, and that is it. Please send me comments on my website about the recipe. Let me know that you like it. And give me feedback. I'd love to hear from all of you. Okay, and you can also send me an email at bhavani@ieatgreen.com, and I'd be happy to answer you. So now it's my pleasure to introduce my guest, Mish Bakker. She is an acupuncturist and herbalist turned chef and food stylist. So she didn't start out as a chef. She started out as an acupuncturist and herbalist. She's the co-founder of Molly B. Sweets, which is a custom confectionery studio located in Greenport, New York. And Molly B. cakes, chocolates, shortbreads, and other small indulgences are all made with fresh, local ingredients. And her bakery has been featured in Food Network magazine, Hamptons magazine, Well-Wed magazine, Brides New York, and New York Times. Molly B.'s hand-painted peony cake was named one of the 24 most beautiful cakes in America by Brides magazine. Mish has worked alongside some of the world's most renowned chefs and is dedicated to bringing excellence and innovation to the table. She's taught many, many cooking classes from William Sonova to private venues. And she's a member and a former leader of Slow Food East End. so a fellow slow foodie. And Misha is constantly seeking out creative uses for herbs, flowers, and spices in recipes, both savory and sweet. And her new cookbook is so beautiful. It's called Cooking with Flowers, Sweet and Savory Recipes with Rose Petals, Lilacs, Lavenders, and Other Edible Flowers, which features more than 100 recipes that will bring beautiful flower-filled dishes to your kitchen table. Misha, you with me?
I am with you. Hi, Bhavani.
Hi. Your book is just so beautiful. You know, I've used flowers for years, but really just in decorating. You know, I decorated all my cakes with fresh flowers, you know, when I was doing weddings a lot. And there's nothing more beautiful. But your book is just great because it takes cooking with flowers to a whole nother level.
Thank you.
Another level.
Thank you so much. I mean, I really think that people, when they think about, for the most part, I would say, as a whole, when people think about flowers and edible flowers, they do think about them in a decorative way. So my goal was to open people's minds to the uses, sweet and savory, for edible flowers.
Mm-hmm. So before we get totally into your book, which I know we could take our whole show for that. I'm just curious, on a personal level, what turned you to food from acupuncture and herbal medicine?
Well, I've always loved food. And honestly, in my study of acupuncture and herbal medicine, I realized, you know, one of the biggest realizations I had was that food is medicine. And, you know, as somebody who loves food and does not like to necessarily limit myself to, you know, no carbs and no sugar, and no, I just kind of thought, how can I practice my philosophy of food as medicine, but still be able to, you know, be indulgent in food. And what happened for me was that even though I loved being an acupuncturist and I loved being an herbalist, I loved being involved with food more. And that particular aspect of the healing arts appealed to me the most.
Mm-hmm.
So,
That's in my history, I actually had gone as far as applying to acupuncture school, getting in and almost going, and I ended up sticking with food myself.
Yeah, I have to say I love the study and practice of acupuncture. And when we moved from California to New York, I had studied acupuncture as an apprentice. And unfortunately, apprenticeship is not a recognized form of study in many states, New York being one of them. So even though I had passed my board and passed the California acupuncture test, the national test, all of that, New York State wanted me to go through the process of going to a school. And so it was the appropriate time to say, you know what, I love food anyway. Let's just
right.
do food. But I have to say, having said that, there's nothing like acupuncture, particularly acupuncture for balance and wellness, not just for critical care.
Mm-hmm.
Or acute
people
care.
Don't usually think of it as, you know, as routine maintenance, you know.
Yes.
They do think of it as something you go to when you have an acute problem.
It's true, and for me, the practice of acupuncture was always about balance, and so it just falls in line with me more to go with the food aspect of it as well.
So how does that work, your acupuncture work, inform your current work?
It informs it in that I understand the synergistics of food and the balance of food, and I really do believe in moderation. But for instance, when I'm formulating something, and I always joke that I'm justifying the eating of these things, but when I'm formulating something like a chocolate bar and I've got dark chocolate with hibiscus and raspberry, you know, I can look at that food and I can say, well, okay, yes, you know, there's sugar in there. There clearly is. And there's caffeine and there are things in there that should only be had in small doses. They're very, you know, yin foods and indulgent foods. But I'm balancing out that with the raspberry and the hibiscus, which are, you know, sour in flavor and they have, you know, some healing energy, and they balance the other food. So I think that it informs my work because I'm more adventurous in what I use, and I'm able to think outside the box of even with a wedding cake. You know, I've been known to do you know, a little bit more outside the box things and make herbal syrups that go with my cakes and use things that people wouldn't expect to find in their dessert.
Mm-hmm.
And that is because I'm thinking about, you know, how can I justify the eating of this?
Right. Right, because usually sugar, you know, when you're talking about balance and you're talking about
sugar doesn't
healthy
come into play.
Food, usually sugar is, you know, probably the least recognized as having
health
benefits.
Absolutely. It's low man on the totem pole. And in my practice, I only use organic sugar. I'm very strict and firm about certain things. I prefer organic and local eggs whenever I can get them, local dairy products whenever I can get them. There's something far more life-giving about those. And in fact, in my food, not just lip service to that, but I find in my food, people say, "Wow, your sweets are a lot less sweet." They are, because I'm using organic sugar, and so even though it's sugar, I pound for pound, ounce for ounce, you know, whatever it is, I'm actually using less of the refinement of the actual sucrose molecule, and there are more impurities and more of the wholeness of the plant is brought into my food. And I'm pretty across the board strict about only using organics in that way.
So are you saying you think organic sugar is less sweet? Like
absolutely.
A cup of organic sugar is less than a cup of regular sugar?
I would bet my whole nut on it, yes.
Really?
Absolutely. Because you're dealing with something that has a lot more impurities, and so it's going to be more complex in flavor and less sweet.
Mm-hmm.
And
I've only used organic sugar, you know,
yeah.
So I really don't know the other.
Sure,
You know, and, you know, I've used recipes where it calls for, you know, a cup of sugar, certainly not organic, and I use organic and tastes perfect.
Yeah, exactly.
So
it tastes perfect.
You know, I don't know. Right. I don't know if I had made it with regular sugar, if it would have been sweeter.
I would bet that it would be sweeter.
Uh-huh.
And again, that it would be less complex. There'd be something less about it and something more about it. And the more about it would be more sweet, and the less about it would be, you know, or the more about it would be more complex, and the less about it would be less sweet.
Now, do you use other sweeteners besides sugar?
I do.
Somebody wants
yeah.
a cake without sugar.
I do. I use agave nectar. I use maple syrup because maple syrup now is the most complex of all of the sweeteners, and has the most nutrition. So I do use that. I use honey as a sweetener. There are very rare occasions that I do have to use something like Truvia, but I do. It's not my inclination to go that route. There's a cookie that I make that I call the free cookie. It's gluten-free, dairy-free, egg-free, sugar-free, and we sweeten that with applesauce. My granola is sweetened with brown rice syrup. So, yeah, I do go the direction of other sweeteners. When I'm talking about a wedding cake, I have to say I'm going with sugar pretty much across the board, unless somebody's allergic to it, in which case I will have to substitute.
Right, right.
But pretty much across the board in that way, and again across the board in organic sugar. And I always say to a bride, you know, you're not going to get a white buttercream from me. It's always going to be off-white because my sugar is off-white. There's nothing white about what I'm doing.
Right. Right. And it's such a prettier color anyway, I think.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Right? Absolutely.
It's just soft, especially, you know, when I saw the pictures, you know, with, you know, the flowers just opposed to the cream color buttercream. It's just gorgeous.
Yeah.
And it's so much softer than a bright white would be.
I agree. Absolutely.
You know,
yeah, it's so much.
Looks more elegant. Yeah.
It is. Across the board, in all ways, to all the senses, I think it's more appealing.
Yeah, I agree. So when you're using some of these other sweeteners, do you use anything regularly in your recipe to counteract the heaviness of, let's say, the maple syrup or the honey?
Oh, you have to adjust everything. Oh, my goodness. Everything gets adjusted. You can't just one-for-one substitute another sweetener for sugar. You really have to work. And that is chemistry, and that is work, and that is balance. And you know, that is part of the art and science, actually, of being in the kitchen, is realizing that, you know, even though when people think of sugar, they think of it in terms of a solid in a recipe, but it does actually act as a liquid in a recipe. However, it becomes a liquid in a recipe. It doesn't start out as one, whereas the other sweeteners, agave, honey, maple syrup, those start out as liquids. So you do have to balance how that they act.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing, you know, like an egg, you actually, when you're using eggs in a recipe, they actually act as a solid, not as a liquid. So it's counterintuitive, but you do, and that's where the chemistry of the kitchen comes into play.
Right, because when you cook an egg, it becomes solid. When you cook sugar, it melts.
Exactly.
So, yeah, I see that. Mm-hmm. I know when I used to do a lot more baking with my kids when they were little and I didn't want to give them sugar, I would be using maple syrup a lot. And I found using shredded coconut would very much give that lighter texture. Like I could add shredded coconut to a recipe just a little bit, and that would make it flakier, you know.
Sure,
I would see it up.
Yeah, absolutely, because it would actually give space between the molecules. So
exactly.
I see how that. Yeah.
And that was, you know, a little trick that I'm sharing with all my listeners out there right now, that it works great, you know. And I actually would put it through the food processor first,
mm-hmm.
but it was even finer than how it came right out of the bag. You know, I'm talking about the unsweetened shredded.
Yeah, those tiny little flakes. And that is another thing, is that, you know, experimenting with different flours. If you're substituting in something like maple syrup or honey that is heavier, and you're using the straight wheat flour, sometimes it helps, like you're saying, to add a little coconut, which in essence you're almost turning that into coconut flour or rice flour or something like that. So it does help, yes, to adjust mm-hmm. the amounts in that way as well, adjust the flours. They absorb the liquids differently.
Uh-huh. So I want to go back to talking more about flours, but before we do, we're already halfway through the show, so I want to take a couple-minute break. And when we come back, I really want to talk about edible flours and your inspiration in working with them. So, okay? So don't go anywhere, everyone out there listening. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and my guest is Mish Bakker from Edible Flours. Be right back. Everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Mish Bakker, from the author of a new wonderful cookbook called Cooking with Flours, Sweet and Savory Recipes with Rose Petals, Lilacs, Lavenders, and Other Edible Flours. Mish, are you with me?
I am with you.
Great. So what brought you to writing about edible flours, and how did you first get involved with working with flours?
I've been involved with working with flowers, I think, my whole life, but only on the fringes when I was young. You know, when I was young, just like many, many little girls, I used to play with flowers, make mud pies and decorate them, and, you know, make daisy chains and things like that. And naturally, I would pull the honeysuckle ends apart and lick the dew. But it wasn't until I started studying herbs and acupuncture that I realized that food, you know, that flowers could be medicinal. And then from there, you know, what they say, you know, the little tiny window opens and all of a sudden the whole screen door flies open. So what happened for me was, as I was learning about these flowers as medicine, I also went to a dinner party where I was living, and somebody had flowers in their salad, and I thought, oh, wow, you know, that's so cool. I just, you know, I didn't think about flowers in this way. And so I started thinking about how I could use flowers in food aside from the embellishment of a salad. When I started thinking about it, I started thinking how many different ways there were. And then I started exploring how many different flowers were actually edible. And I was shocked at what I found. It was not until many, many years later that it was suggested to me by a woman in the publishing world that I write a book. And the editor that I was working with asked if I knew anything or knew anybody who knew anything about edible flowers. And she had always wanted to work on something involving them, and I thought, oh my gosh, wow, this is what I've been looking for forever. And so we began this project.
Mm-hmm. And how long did the project take from start to finish?
It took from start to finish was about a year, and I was so fortunate to have an incredible team. My photographer is Miana June, and she just captured my vision in a million ways that I couldn't even articulate. And she and I were the primary food stylists, but then we had other helpers, like her husband Anthony LaSala helped us, and my friend Nanao Anton helped us. And so we had other helpers, and my editor at Quirk, Margaret McGuire, deserves a world of credit for just inspiring the work and for guiding it. I was really, really lucky to work with a really wonderful team. My cousin Lori Catalano, Weisenberg Catalano, helped in styling, and we shot all of the work either at my studio or at another friend's house, and used all props from, you know, each one of us had different items that we just loved that we wanted to use in the book. So we were really lucky in pulling this whole thing off.
Uh-huh. I can't believe only a year. It is beautiful.
Thank you.
I thought you were going to say five, you know.
No, and believe me, there's enough on the cutting room floor for another volume.
I do believe that. So what is your favorite flower?
People ask that all the time. I'm fickle. I'm really fickle. My favorite flower is the one in front of me at the moment. I love them all separately and equally, like my children.
Uh-huh. How many children do you have?
I only have two children, but I love them separately and equally, so uh-huh. There are no favorites here. I would say that, you know, again, at the moment, whichever one I'm working with is my favorite, but if I had to choose one flower that I could only use one flower for the rest of my life, I would say I would narrow it to either a calendula or nasturtium and go from there.
Uh-huh.
So,
what flower was the biggest surprise to you?
Oh, that's a good question. I would say that hibiscus was probably the biggest surprise for me.
Why?
Because I didn't realize how much I loved it and how really versatile it was. And it has this quality that when it's dried, it's actually better than fresh. And I always have this, you know, conception that fresh is best. But the dried hibiscus has this, it concentrates the flavor. It becomes tartar, and it doesn't texturally rob anything. And so it surprised me.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed it.
I remember being really surprised finding out that dried mushrooms,
right,
were, you know, had more flavor and were actually nutritionally even better.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. So hibiscus was the one that surprised me in that way.
Uh huh. Cool.
Although
cool.
I find people all the time saying, "I didn't know you could eat orchids," or "I didn't know," you know. So there are lots of people who I encounter who didn't realize you could eat something that they were, you know, growing in their house or their backyard. Lilacs, people don't realize are edible, and they sure are.
Uh-huh. Lilies also, right?
Well, not all lilies, actually. You have to be careful with lilies. Day lilies are edible, but common lilies are not necessarily edible. And the day lilies, I mean, they've been used as medicine. That was one of the first flowers that I encountered way back when in my studies, because day lilies have been used for centuries and centuries in Chinese medicine as a stomach tonic. So that was one of the first things that I encountered in daylilies. And let me say, daylily buds are yummy. I tend to, even though I am known for my sweet things, I tend to love the savory, not the sweet. And so a roasted daylily bud for me is like heaven. So good.
And how do you roast it? With olive oil in the oven?
Yeah, actually, just take the daylily buds and a little bit of olive oil. I like a little bit of Malden and a little bit of Malden salt and a little bit of ground pepper.
So good.
Oh my gosh, flaky.
Oh my God.
Light. It's one of my favorite salts.
Hey, you guys, if you don't know of it, it's Malden. Is it?
Malden. Malden.
Malden salt.
Yeah.
Flakes. They are so good. I guess you can get them at Whole Foods. I don't know where else you can get them, but they are exquisite. Okay, go
so
on.
So good. And then just roast that. Just throw the whole pan in the oven at, you know, 350, 375, and let it roast away. And I'm sure, and I haven't done it, but I'm quite sure that they'd do just as well on the grill, in a grill pan. And if you have access to local salt, like out east where I live, Amagansett Sea Salt is a salt company that's just sprung up, and there are two more salt companies that are, there's a North Fork Salt Company that's coming into fruition, and there's another salt company. So try your local salts with your local day lilies, and, you know, what a great thing to invite friends over, and you could even have a, you know, BYOD, bring your own day lily bud party.
So these are buds before they open,
before
right?
They
not,
open.
Not after.
No, before they open, and they're best actually when they're young and small, so they're best when they're, like, no more than about 3 inches long, because after that they start to get more fibrous and less poppy. But when they're, you know, between 2 and 3 inches long, they're just snappy and tender and so good.
You have to have a lot of lilies to be willing to take all those beautiful buds, though.
You definitely have to have
right?
a lot of lilies. But I have to say, when you start cooking with flowers, what's going to happen is you're going to start realizing, you're going to start, you know, driving around your neighborhood going, oh, my God, those guys have daylilies in their yard. Oh, my gosh.
You're going to start that now.
That's right. You're going to start noticing all the flowers in all the abandoned lots. And, you know, and I caution people all the time, don't just pick something from the side of the road, because of course from the side of the road it's got exhaust fume on it, but certainly notice abandoned lots and you know your neighbor's yards, and don't be afraid to knock on their door and swap them something for their lovely rose petals. So particularly if your neighbors like mine don't use chemicals on their stuff.
So what do you do with rose petals?
Rose petals are really wonderful. I do a lot of work with turning them. I actually like to spin them into, you know, into my sugar and have this rose sugar so I can scent things. But I also use roses on as a vinegar, and I like rose vinegar a lot for poultry and for even for meat. And I don't eat a lot of it, but my family likes poultry and meat. So I like to kind of make dressings and things like that out of the roses. It's an unexpected flavor when you're dealing with something so savory.
Uh-huh. So, and what about rose water? Can you make rose water?
I think that rose water is very challenging to make. You actually have to distill it in order to make it. So, yes, if you want to set up a distillation, you could actually, you know, rather than having a still in your backyard for whiskey or rye, you could actually have a still for rose water. That would be kind of fun. But
you
yes,
haven't done that. It's more complicated.
I haven't. It is more complicated, but I do use rose water. I do purchase rose water and use it, and I use it in all kinds of things. And I do use it on my berries. I like to, again, I like to spin roses into sugar and just mix it with heavy cream to make a little whipped cream for my fresh berries. I think it's heavenly. That and
spin roses into sugar. So do you chop them or?
I actually take the roses and I put them, you know, maybe a handful of roses. What would that be? Maybe a half to a cup of roses into 2 cups of sugar. And I put it that in the Cuisinart and spin it up until the roses are completely macerated and the sugar is colored. And I'll use that in small doses in whipped cream and in other foods. You know, if I'm flavoring just a simple butter cookie, can be flavored that way. Anything that you would use sugar for, you can use a flour sugar for.
Wow.
And it just, again, it adds another layer to the flavor. So, you know,
sometimes the red and the pink for different things.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Well, the thing about flowers is, and particularly roses and tulips have this as well. The different colors taste different. And not only different colors, but the you want to smell the flower first because the way it smells is going to indicate the way it tastes. And then you want to taste it because certainly not all roses are created equal. A rose is not a rose is not a rose is not a rose.
And some roses these days don't even smell.
No, some roses don't smell, and some roses taste really bitter. I mean, really bitter. And flowers in general, like if I were asked to say what is the general taste of a flower, I would say it's bitter. Flowers, you know, the general taste of a flower is not sweet. Surprise, surprise.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But that bitterness is actually healthy. You know, we all need a little bit of bitter in our diets.
There was a great article in the New York Times a few weeks ago in the dining section about bitter greens and how we've actually cultivated greens to be less bitter because people seem to like that more, but they're not as healthy.
No, they're not as healthy. And so when people ask me about the health benefits of flowers, I mean, you know, flowers contain phytonutrients and they contain antioxidants and they are very high in vitamins. A lot of them are high in vitamin A, D, C, E. They're so high. Lutein, they contain, every flower is different, you know, so every flower is going to contain different nutrients. But those nutrients tend to make the flowers taste a little bit more bitter. And, you know, you have to get around that when you're eating them. But I don't mind that flavor at all. In fact, I like it. And so a lot of my recipes use flowers the way I would use herbs, and I use them as flavoring. And I also am conscious of the fact that when I'm making something like that, I am absorbing the health benefits. So if I'm having, you know, my flower jam, for instance, my, you know, violet jam, well, violet is so high in antioxidants. Look at how vivid the blue color is, right? Aren't we supposed to eat tons of blue food? Well,
right.
You know, there it is. You couldn't get more blue than a violet unless you're talking about a black pansy. And so the amount of antioxidants packed into that little thing are tremendous.
Now, does the nutritional value go out when you cook with it?
Yes, to some extent it does. Not in every case, but to some extent it does. But for instance, if you're making your flowers into tea, you're not going to lose a lot of nutrients. But if you're cooking them at high temperatures, yeah, you are going to lose some of the nutrients. Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
As with any food.
Exactly.
You know, in its raw state, it's going to have far more nutrients.
Uh-huh. And are all of them good eating raw, or are some flowers only good for cooking?
You can eat all flowers raw. It's a personal taste preference, I think. For instance, I don't love lavender raw. I might be one of those rare people, but I just don't love lavender raw. For me, it has to be made into something. But I do know a lot of people who do like it.
Right.
Personal,
and since flowers are so seasonal, how do you extend the season?
That's a good question.
Drying?
Yeah, well, you can dry the flowers, or you can press them into butters, which then you can freeze. You can make them into vinegars, which will last in your refrigerator for a very long time. And even out of the refrigerator, a flower vinegar will last a very long time. You can do as I suggested and spin them into sugar, which, again, then you'll have for a while. And, you know, you're extending your season that way.
Do you need to refrigerate that after you put a flower in it?
If you spin them, if you really crush them up, but you do need to keep them airtight. You don't necessarily need to refrigerate them, but you do need to keep them airtight.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
You can turn them into, you know, conserves and jams, and that extends your life. And, you know, from a conserve or a jam, you can then make a vinaigrette. You can, you know, you can make a sauce. You know, we're constantly adding, you know, when you make a sauce, you know, you might want to add a little bit of orange jam. Or, well, you know, what's the difference of adding a little bit of hibiscus jelly to a sauce? So that's the way you can extend your season best. Short of that, yes, you can use dried flowers, and certain flowers are even better dried. Again, the hibiscus is one of them. Lavender is really wonderful dried. I do use some roses dried, though I don't texturally really love them. So, and that's a personal preference thing. Some people really go nuts over them. I it's just, for me, not my favorite thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how I
know some people actually putting flowers into different liquors to flavor,
yes,
you know, a vodka or something.
Absolutely,
like that.
Absolutely. And I have those recipes in my book as well. I think, how fun would it be to just have an entire flowered cocktail party? And, you know, I've suggested for kids' parties, and we've actually done this. My children
cocktail
have done
parties
it.
For kids?
No, a flowered tea party. So for the adults, you'd have a flower cocktail party, and for the kids, you do a flowered tea party. And I think that those things are really, really fun to do. Even just have a flower ice cream tasting, and, you know, flights of things like that. I think it's really fun and a really cool way to get community involved. I'm always thinking about, how can I introduce this to other people, and how can I mean, for me, food is about community and coming together over the table. And that all engenders and fosters communication and growth and understanding and tolerance. And so why not do that over flowers food? How wonderful. And a flower cocktail party? Yeah.
Sounds heavenly. Heavenly.
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you're another slow foodie, because we love to bring people together around food and sharing it. I mean, that's the beauty of it. You know, what fun is it just by yourself, right?
Exactly. That's exactly right. Yeah.
So food is, you know, such a transient thing. And, you know, if you're looking at food as your art, I know I have this. Do you ever think of yourself as, you know, like a Tibetan monk, you know, when they make those beautiful sand drawings and then someone just, you know, the wind just takes it away? You know, you create a beautiful work of art and then it's cut into and eaten.
That's exactly right. And I think that if we practice that, and I always say, yes, you know, people look at my work and, oh, it's so beautiful, and then it's gone, and what, and how do you feel about that? But I always think that if I could practice the same way I feel about that with all other aspects of my life, in all other aspects of my life, the letting go, the creating something and then letting it go, the non-attachment of the physical, you know, I still have the memory of the creation of that, and I still have the, hopefully, the memory of the people's faces as they're eating what I've made. And I think that that's better and more important. And if I can practice the non-attachment, gosh, if I could do that in all the other areas of my life, I think how much healthier would I be?
Right.
So,
right. There is something really about, you know, being that Buddhist monk and being, you know, the non-attachment and, you know, and letting go of the ego connection to the work of art and just letting it be, stand by itself.
Exactly.
Very cool. Very cool. So I just heard you closed your bakery. Is that true?
It's true. I did.
Tell me about that.
Well, there have been circumstances in my life that are, in the last year, my stepfather passed away and my mom is ill. So I closed my shop, and I am going to be focusing my energy around my wholesale work and around actually doing a little bit more writing and a little bit more speaking. So I think that I can use the time that I was using in the shop to kind of allocate some more of that to family time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a bittersweet thing. I loved having the shop, and I loved seeing people and meeting people in the everyday experience of that. And I hope to be able to maintain that. I'm starting to, as I settle in, conceive of doing my blog on a more regular basis, and I hope to be able to interact with people in that way, and in speaking and traveling and
right.
And substitute that in for the
well, you know, it's so important to take that family time when the time is there, because
yeah.
it won't be there at another time. And so I had to do the same in those years that I had with my folks. Was the best. You know,
yeah.
I can't get it back. So
no,
good decision. I understand the bittersweet of it, but I'm really glad you're doing what you're doing, because your book is really, really inspirational, and you have a lot to share with so many people. Thank you so much for joining us. Everybody out there, I've been talking with Mish Bakker, who just wrote a beautiful book called Cooking with Flowers. Find it at your local bookstore or Amazon.com. And you've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'll be with you again next week. Hope to see you at some of our slow food events, and have a great rest of the week. Be well.